everyone. Welcome to Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzes here with co-host Eric versus the World Jackson. What do you think, Eric? Pretty good?
Okay. Not your finest.
Not my finest. Okay. And very special guest friend of Stutter Talk, Charlie Osborne. Hey, Charlie, you with us?
I'm right here. Yep.
Great.
Hey, Charlie.
Charlie Osborne is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point. He teaches the Fluency Disorders course and other courses, supervises in the clinic, and provides clinical services at St. Michael's Hospital. Mr. Osborne is the past editor of the ASTRA Division for Perspectives on Fluency and Fluency Disorders, a peer-reviewed journal, which is how I met Mr. Osborne. And Charlie has worked with children and adults who stutter for over 20 years. And for those who have met Charlie, he has an uncanny resemblance to Bob Kweezel.
Well, he also has a really great beard.
Thanks. Bob's is pretty good, too.
Yeah, Bob's is good, too. I felt like I had to comment because I'm in the process right now of growing another beard, and I feel the beard, and I like your beard.
Well, so, and you know, and when you get down to it, shaving really sucks.
And it takes a lot of time, you know, and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not that great at it either.
I am surrounded by mountain men. And, you know, the funny thing is I just took a shave before the show. It's sort of this new thing I'm doing where before we record an episode, I shower, I shave, and I put on fresh clothes. I know, it sounds kind of nutty, doesn't it? But, okay, moving right along.
Let's get going.
All right. So, Charlie, there are many reasons we asked you to join us on Stutter Talk today. One of them is that when Eric and I saw you at the National Stuttering Association conference over the summer, you had on a great, great shirt. And it said, and I quote, "Fluency, the other F word." What do you mean by that, Charlie?
Well, I think it kind of speaks for itself. I don't know. Somewhere along the line, I got tired of telling students, in when I supervised in clinic, they were, you know, oh, that was really fluent, and it just became such an I don't know what the word, but I would have such a negative reaction to it because I don't know what fluent means, and most often when the student's in there working with the client, I mean, the end goal isn't fluency, and so, but I mean, that hasn't happened in years now because I just made up a T-shirt and I thought, well, this will get the message across, and I told students I think I'd rather have them use the other F word instead of the fluent word, just because I don't have a stronger reaction to it. So that's kind of where that came from.
You know, we at Stutter Talk, we have joked about fining ourselves a dollar or two for every time we use the F word. But of course, we agree with you, the F word is fluency. You have a special interest in fluency. You've studied it. You've written papers on it. When you were the editor of the Perspectives Journal on Fluency and Fluency Disorders, you edited a journal that was dedicated, you edited an issue of the journal that was dedicated to this topic. Why do you have a special interest in not only stuttering, but in fluency?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think somewhere along the line, when I was just starting out as a clinician, well, I would tape sessions, and then watch them. You know, it's good for, it's oftentimes a little tough to take having to watch yourself, but it's a good, you know, it's a good way to self evaluate and see how you're doing. And what I noticed, well, actually, this was a different time. I was using the tapes. We were trying to edit tapes down to use for presentation. And I thought, you know, if anybody watched this, they'd probably think that I was the client because I was so disfluent, using lots of repetitions And somewhere along the line as a clinician, so that was one of the things that kind of it kind of made increased my awareness of the disfluencies that I have. And another,
I just want to jump in for a second, Charlie. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
For our listeners, you are not a person who stutters. Is that correct?
Not even close. Yeah, of course not.
No.
I was hoping you wouldn't do that, just so that we could. Because of the topic, I was hoping we could just let it go for a while. Because when the three of us were at the NSA conference, Charlie, we were discussing the fact that sometimes when we were talking to people in the elevator and such, we didn't know if they were stutterers or not.
Uh-huh.
Which I think speaks to the very issue that you're talking about right now.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. Of course, I think it depends on what your definition of stuttering is, too. Because I've had people, I remember after one presentation that was at a state conference, someone came up afterwards and said, introduce yourself as another person who stutters. And I'm like, it was one of those presentations where out of the blue, I didn't realize I was going to be nervous, and I was. For some whatever reason, and it hit me right in my speech.
Mm. So, do you ever just accept it though, and be like, "Yeah, you're right."
Well, of course, I don't. Yeah, you know, I think that if you define stuttering strictly by a percent of stuttered syllables, there'd probably be somebody out there that'd want to put me in therapy. But you know, that's not my definition. I think that it's the experience of speaking that really qualifies someone as a person who stutters or not, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I do, and when I looked over the articles you sent us, and when I looked at an article you had co-written with, I think, your colleague Leslie Plonsker, am I saying her name right?
Mm-hmm.
You made me think of some of the conversations we've had with Bob Quisel, where Bob has said, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but something to the extent that stuttering at its core is the loss of control. And some of the things you sent me, it made me rethink about that.
The experience of a loss of control.
Thank you, Eric.
We really don't have a firm, a defining definition of what fluency is. In fact, when you start looking at people who are, quote, I just have to say quote because I hate the F word, fluent speakers, they're really not fluent when you stop and look at them. I'll keep bantering here.
Please.
You mentioned Leslie Plonsker and our article. We've been examining the speech of young college students who have no history of speech problems, you know, no history or background of any stuttering or anything. And we have been using Wingate have put together a classification system for categorizing speech, and it includes what he considered normal disfluencies, and it goes back to the mid-60s hesitation phenomena with on blanking on the author now. But anyhow, we have about 175 samples of young college students, and we're in the process of trying to analyze them using Wingate's analysis form. And it's just a riot sometimes. I mean, these people that no one would, you know, you would listen to them and you wouldn't think anything. But when you go back and you really listen for these different kinds of behaviors, I mean, as listeners, we gloss over all the mess that is included as a part of speech.
Well, you have said that fluency is a myth, and you know, when I read that, I smile. I think, comrade. So, you know, is fluency a myth? Is there something that is fluency, or is there just stuttering and everything else is not stuttering? Or is that a myth too?
You know, I think it's that's a hard question to answer. I think that there's not a simple answer to it. I think that I'm trying to remember from Wingate, and I liked what he said, but it's not very clear. But he said he felt that fluency or normal speech is just whatever seems to be accepted by the cultural group you're a part of, as and it doesn't, nothing sticks out.
Do you use when either working with clients or working with your colleagues, do you use the term fluency, or do you kind of try and not use the term fluency and be more descriptive and all of that?
You said the word descriptive. Now you're getting into Williams territory.
Johnson territory, right?
Do I use the word? Yeah, well, I usually start out by saying I spit on the word fluency and tell them, you know, you're not going to hear me say it because it's not a very descriptive term, and I think it's almost like been many people's holy grail, and you're never going to get it. How would you know that you're even there once you're there, because it's such an ill-defined term?
I guess as I asked you the question there, part of me almost thinks like it is a descriptive term in a sense, when you're just talking about the overt characteristics of speech, you know, but when we're talking about stuttering and why a lot of us make such a big deal about it is that you're completely neglecting what really makes stuttering a problem for a lot of people when you just use that term, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I could just sort of jump around a little bit here, Charlie, this topic of fluency that you're so interested in is really making me think about therapy, as I'm sure it does you too. And I don't know if you guys had a chance to see it, an article that's in press in the Journal of Fluency Disorders. It's by Alperman and his colleagues, or I think his colleagues, titled Measurement of Trained Speech Patterns in Stuttering. And one of the things I thought was so interesting, and I'm going to read a quote here. Measuring the use or discontinuation of trained speech patterns requires that these trained speech patterns can be distinguished clearly from spontaneous fluent speech. Well, most of the people I know in the field, I think, would think that trained speech patterns are supposed to be fluency, not supposed to be distinguishable from fluency. So I'm starting to think the entire field is confused. And I don't know if you said this, Charlie, or if I'm saying it or if we're all saying it, but, you know, are we really talking about stuttering and the absence of stuttering? I mean, does this word fluency hold any meaning at all? Or is that another hard question?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I did look at the article, and I thought the same thing. I thought, well, if you can recognize what they were calling the trained?
The trained speech patterns, yeah.
And then how natural is that? How fluent is that?
Yeah.
I mean, well, anyhow, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I have an adult support group, and we meet every month, and have been doing this for years. And I remember several years ago, and of course, as a part of doing this research with Leslie Plonsker, I'd bring in stuff and say, "Hey, you know, get a load of this. This is normal." But at one point, I remember, and this was one of the well-attended groups. I had at least 8 people there. And I asked the question to each, I put it to each of these people, and these are people who consider themselves controlled speakers, meaning that, you know, they feel like they have a sense of control when they talk. It doesn't mean that they're wonderfully fluent all the time. And I asked the question, I said, who do you feel is a better communicator, you or the average Joe out on the street who doesn't stutter? And it was really telling, because to a person, they said, oh, I'm a much better communicator because of all the time I've spent focusing on it, a level of awareness that I have as a communicator, and it really just kind of blew me away. I thought that was a pretty good indication, though, of an answer from someone who has a sense of control as a communicator.
I just had a thought here. As we're talking, I keep thinking of the term spontaneous fluency. I think that we all, our panties all get in a bunch when we hear this term fluency, and we hear it being the goal of lots of different types of therapy. But I'm sitting here thinking, well, yeah, so just put the word spontaneous before it, and why don't we just say, well, a large goal in therapy is spontaneous fluency. So it's not this like trained, monitored sense of fluency, but it's something else. It's something that seems a lot more natural and quite frankly sounds a lot more natural.
Mm-hmm. It's still kind of, I mean, God, I just have such an aversion to the F word in its entirety. How about spontaneous communicator?
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, that's better. I suppose. I guess I was trying to cave a little bit there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead, Charlie.
Oh, no. It's not that I'm not a anti-fluency Nazi.
Oh, well, we are.
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Okay. Well, maybe I am, but I was just trying to. I'm giving a little ground too, man.
Right. Well, I think I liked when you. When you use the term spontaneous in there too, like I think that's such a huge, I think that that's a piece that a lot of people miss, actually, Peter. You know, like the part of communication that is supposed to feel spontaneous and is supposed to feel natural.
In the paper you co-wrote with Leslie Plonsker in 2007, you guys point out, Charlie, that normal fluency contains on average about 6 disfluencies per 100 words. That sort of surprised me. That's higher than I expected. Perhaps it shouldn't surprise me, but just seeing that on paper, that seems pretty interesting. I'm not sure if most stutterers or speech pathologists would know that.
I my guess would be that they wouldn't. There's another article in that issue from a psychologist in her area of interest is looking at the quote disfluent. Now there was a nice one. I was looking over the article Leslie and I had written, and if I could go back, I would change. We talked about some of these behaviors as error behaviors. And I would go back and change that because I don't think they're error behaviors. I think as I'm looking for the other article by the psychologist, she talks about that many of our uhs and our ums, even some of the prolonged words that we use as an aspect of regular talking, they serve a function. They cue the listener, or if I use an I'm looking for a word and I want to keep my turn. And that's my cue to the listener.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead, John.
Oh no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, this makes therapy quite a challenge because when you're working with somebody who clearly is using some of these disfluencies as part of the stuttering, and then you recognize that they're going through some type of change, then you have to reevaluate not only the therapist but certainly the speaker. You know, well, how is he or she using these, quote, normal disfluencies now? Are they still part of the stuttering, or are they normal?
Yeah, and how do you measure that?
Yeah, and it's very telling. Like I record many of my sessions and give a copy to the client, and it's very telling when you both watch it, like, or you're in the moment, and the client doesn't know what just happened. The client doesn't know, was that or was that so you know was that stuttering? Or was that part of holding the communication floor or trying to formulate language? The client honestly doesn't know.
Wow.
I have to call Peter out right now.
Go ahead.
Peter, I distinctly remember about 8 or 9 or 10 months ago or something, where we were having one of our friendly disagreements, where we were talking about being able to determine whether a filler and avoidance like that was a stuttered like avoidance or it was a not it was just part of normal speech, like the filler garbage speech that we use. And you clearly said that, oh no, I think we could pretty much tell all of the time when it's related to stuttering and when it's not. And you floored me at that time with that comment. So please.
Yeah. Eric, I honestly don't remember the specifics of that conversation. I remember what you're talking about. You know, I certainly stand by what I just said now, and I really don't remember the specifics of that.
He's just trying to be on his best behavior in front.
No, I'm being totally serious.
I was trying to get into it with him right now, but
no, I can't argue a point that I have to listen to it again to remember exactly what we were talking about. I do think there are certainly times where you know when the filler is an avoidance or part of the stuttering, and there are times where you're not sure. And, you know, no, please, Charlie, it's your turn. No, it's your turn, Charlie.
Well, I think that when you just said that, though, I think it's fair game to ask the person, why did you just do that? Was that an or was that an
What I'm finding interesting is sometimes the client really doesn't know. And
exactly. Yeah. That's right.
But sometimes.
I think that's so true, and I think that I think a lot about how important it really is to be so militant in kind of teasing out whether it was a stutter like avoidance or not. I don't really know in unless it's the type of pattern where it's I'm like you know where it's really pronounced. I don't think that a lot of the time we can tell. And like, how important really is it to our clients in therapy and to us to really be able to tease that apart, Charlie?
Good question. I think it depends on who you're working with. I mean, as you well know, I mean, every client comes in with different ideas of what they want. It's interesting how those ideas change with our guidance, but where they end up, I mean, it's such an individual experience, I think, therapy and how each person defines their own level of success. And I've had individuals who have actually enjoyed, you know, trying to figure out, now why did I just do that? That kind of, I think doing that in a guided way, in a real structured situation can be kind of fun with some people. You know, I think myself being, not the most fluent speaker in the world, it helps. It helps me be a better clinician because I think I'm a really good example of, hey, people, you know, I don't have a problem. I don't view my speech as being an issue.
Because we're doing this, we're not in person. We're doing this over Skype and over the phone. So I can just hear you, Charlie. And I agree with you when you describe yourself as a fairly disfluent non-stutterer. So this is an interesting question to ask you. How do you feel during those, quote, normal disfluencies? Does it have any special feeling to you?
Well, now that I've become, I'm a lot more aware that I do it. Oh no, I don't feel anything. If we weren't on the radio, I could say it a little more plainly how I feel, because I just don't give a poop, you know, about how I sound when I'm doing that. As a part of therapy, when I do it, if I notice that I'm doing something like that, I might draw the client's attention to it so they can hear it. I mean, most of the little kids I work with, when they're done with therapy, they know that, they sound better than I do, at least in their minds, because I can do repetitions like, I can do them all day long.
And be okay, right? I really like this conversation right now. I gotta be honest with you, Charlie, when I heard a couple of those repetitions or disfluencies or whatever we want to call them before coming from you, I like this speaks to how a lot of the times another person can't necessarily be the best judge of what's happening inside somebody else, but like I actually felt like almost a time pressure or something for you to get it out. And it was kind of really, I was like, huh, so that almost feels like stuttering in me. But then when Charlie sits back and he talks about it, he says that I'm not feeling a time pressure. It's not really causing any reaction in me at all. So it's so cool to, you know, speak about it this plainly, I think.
Well, go ahead.
No. You're the guest. You're the guest.
Well, what I think is really cool, and I'm just kind of going back to, I remember, because I like to follow little kids after therapy, and I remember one, and he'd been out for like, I think this was his last visit. I like to see him like annually for every year for 5 years. And so this was his last visit. And of course, you know, I got the speech sample and he sounded just great. And I said, don't you ever do any bouncing? That's what we call repetitions. And he thought about it. He goes, well, yeah, once in a while I'll bounce. And then he paused. He looked at me and said, nothing like you.
Yeah, this is such a pleasure, Charlie, because two stutterers get to look at your speech and not necessarily critique it, but sort of take it apart and talk to you about it. Because in that just back and forth with Eric, you said, I wrote down he, so you said a single syllable whole word repetition three times, and you said the word annually, which sounded like annually, like a little something at the beginning, whether that was a quick repetition or a prolongation, which I think is pretty interesting. So it reminds me of the Yairi research from the University of Illinois, where I think one of the major bullet points outcomes he found was a major difference between young children who stutter and normal speaking children is blocking. And mm-hmm. So do you think that's a big part of what separates you from being a person who stutters, is that you just don't block? You don't have those long blocks?
Oh, man. I don't think I do. I mean, I have surprised myself where I've actually increased some tension as I'm talking. But I don't experience any loss of control. I think that's probably the biggest. Because I know that I have been I don't even want to say at my worst, because then it implies that I think it's something bad. But I've been really disfluent, I mean, I think I've been able to demonstrate pretty much the full range of stutter-like disfluencies. Maybe not, the tension that comes with the blocking, because I don't perceive at whatever level a need to tense. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah,
it makes
a lot of sense. And I have to say that if you were to come into my office, Charlie, and you were to say, I've never dealt with my speech, I think I might stammer or stutter, I'd really like to work on this, I don't think I could say you are a person who stutters, but I certainly think I could say to you, well, there are certainly things we could try to help your speech move forward more easily. And that's pretty interesting that that's perhaps some of the same ideas or approaches one would use with a person who stutters, one could use with somebody who speaks in the manner that you're speaking now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And I'm specifically thinking about things like rate control, not necessarily pullouts and modification and fluency shaping.
And or using use of pauses.
That's exactly where I was going with it. Yeah,
because that's what I use when you know when I want to sound less when I want to sound oh god I almost said the F word. See how easy that happens? Yeah. When I want to sound more fluent, that doesn't mean anything. But when I want to sound want to use fewer disfluencies, that's one of the things I'll do is I'll increase my pause time.
Go ahead, Eric. Hold on.
I think we should get to a break here.
Yeah.
But I do have to say one thing though.
Yeah.
Based on the conversation we're having right now, I feel like it could almost sound like the differentiator in determining the stutterer from the non-stutterer would be how the individual reacts to the breakdowns in whatever you want to call it. And I don't think we're saying that flat out, but a part of it sounds like that, which I don't think is like so far off from the truth.
But I think you would also say, Eric, that there's the neurological, there's the genetic component. I'm pretty sure you would use the whole bag of bread there.
Right. But all the other things being the same, though, I guess you can't really say that.
No. But your point is well taken. You're saying that a major part of stuttering is how people react to it, and I think that's a very valid point that can't be said enough.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Charlie.
Oh no, I was just going to say that kind of goes into the article Mike Susko wrote and the perspectives where he talked about different dimensions of fluency and the one he had two of that really stuck out to me, and one was the speaker's experience and then the other of fluency and the other one was the listener's experience and you know when you think about it, I mean who have we been relying on the most?
Yeah, I think that's such a great point, Charlie, and that's the main point I took from his article too. And when I was reading your article with Plonsker, I made a note, you know, is stuttering, is fluency like pornography? You know it when you see it. And then I thought, but wait a second, that totally discounts the speaker's experience.
Yeah.
You know, so all those are very valid points. I wish we had time to discuss the Susko article and the rest of that is issue, but we really don't. So for our listeners who want to check it out, it's the August 2007 issue of the ASHA Division 4 Perspectives on Fluency and Fluency Disorders. You certainly did not solve the issue of fluency, Charlie, but you shed a lot of light on the topic.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. I hope I sounded fluent enough for you.
I think that's a soundbite right there. That's a Stutter Talk soundbite right there, Charlie. You made the soundbite folder.
And I'm not going to ruin it by asking if you did that on purpose or not. Anyway, you've been listening to Stutter Talk, Peter Reitzes and Eric Jackson here with special guest Charlie Osborne. Stay tuned for more stuttering goodness.
This is Sarah DiAgostino from the National Stuttering Association. If you stutter, you're not alone, and you're listening to StutterTalk.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Dr. Jerry Maguire, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Capstein from Passing Twice, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. Peter Reitzis and Eric Jackson here with the very disfluent, wonderful guest, Charlie Osborne. Hey, Charlie, you still with us today?
Yeah, I'm hanging in there.
That's some introduction.
You know what? I'm just having fun with it. Yeah, it's so great to have these open conversations. What I love, Charlie, is that you're really bringing us to sort of perhaps one of the core of Dean Williams and Wendell Johnson, where we're just talking about speech and we're moving away a little bit from stuttering and fluency just to talking about behaviors. Certainly not denying that there's something called stuttering, but we're talking about behaviors. So you sent us a wonderful chapter by Wendell Johnson and Dorothy Muller from the book Living with Change, The Semantics of Coping, which goes back to 1972, and chapter 5 titled Coping. And I'm realizing now, wait a second, our beloved Dean Williams got a lot of his ideas from, I don't know, but from this chapter, but from the thoughts of Wendell Johnson that are in this chapter. That's pretty much right, right?
I don't know. I know they were both at the University of Iowa, and certainly you see a lot of parallels when you read Johnson and after having read Williams, I think.
There's so many places to jump in with this, so let's go here. One of the things that they point out is that if we set our goals where we can reach them, then we can experience success. Success is a feeling. It's not the name for anything in nature. And I thought that was so interesting. I mean, people in our field don't talk like this anymore. I mean, success is a feeling. It's not anything natural. That's sort of amazing. So, I mean, it sounds to me like what they're saying is about this topic of fluency and stuttering. You know, if you make your goals achievable, then you can achieve them and feel successful. But if you're going into therapy and you're making your goal, well, I'm not going to stutter, I'm going to be fluent in a week, well, you're not going to feel this thing we call success. Are you drawn to that as well, Charlie?
That quote is one of my favorite quotes out of the entire book.
Okay.
Success is just a feeling, because as clinicians, then we can structure experiences in therapy for the client so they can experience success. I mean, we set it at a level that we feel is achievable with our assistance, and a client, whether it's a 3-year-old or a 53-year-old, if we've defined, this is what we're doing. We've described. This is what what constitutes a success or a successful response, and they know that, and then they experience it. Well, then they feel successful.
And how many times have we been in therapy where we're given goals, and perhaps goals are kind of talked about, but especially when we're younger, like. How many times have we thought to ourselves, yeah, I'm striving for something. In a lot of cases, it was, I'm striving for the F word. I'm striving for fluency. But we'd say we're striving for something and not really know what it actually was that we were striving for. So I think that the quote, it takes the magic out of it, you know?
Eric, yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, let's actually define, as best as we can anyway, like what we're trying to do, and then we can create whatever that, you know, feeling of success is. On first glance, I suppose it could sound very like a magical, mystical, that like feeling, but I think what it's actually doing is making it more tangible.
Absolutely, and more salient to the person that's across the table. I'm just going to give one quick little instance. It was just such an amazing thing at the time. I was working with a young man. He was probably late adolescence, and we were working on whatever it was. What we were working on is almost immaterial. We called them speaking controls, and I'm not going to go into what they were. But we were out of the therapy room, and it was the first time we'd gone into this cafeteria-like situation. And, I had a little tape recorder so we'd go back and review it. And so we did this. The whole idea is we were going to have a conversation, then come back and reflect on it. And we get back to the room, and I said, well, how do you think you did? Horrible. Oh, God. It was awful. He says, I said, well, what do you mean awful? He says, well, I probably didn't use the speaking controls more than half the time. I said, so half the time. I said, well, if we'd done this before, when you were in these situations in the past, how much of the time did you feel you were in control? Well, never. I said, well, you went from 0 to 50%. That's a pretty good step. Yeah. And he had to acknowledge, God, that, I guess, that actually was pretty good. But again, it was bringing him back to, What are we qualifying as success in that situation?
Yeah, that's a great point there, Charlie. I'd like to read you a few more quotes, Charlie, to get your feedback on them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is two different pieces that I'm putting together from the chapter. Make your plan of action on the basis of the fewest assumptions you can get by with, then proceed. There is no particular virtue in having 100 tools when you can get the job done with a pair of pliers.
I love that one.
Eric, well, I want to hear from you. I want to ask you first, Charlie, do you sometimes feel that our field of speech-language pathology makes stuttering and the treatment of stuttering way too complicated?
Way too complicated, and I think what it does for a lot of people who don't have a lot of experience working with people with stutter, it scares them off.
Mm.
And what for me as an educator, I want the opposite. And nothing makes me happier than when I get an email from a former student who's all excited because it's somebody who stutters on their caseload.
Yeah, that's a great feeling. Eric, did you want to comment before I threw out a few more things?
It brings me back to the conversation we had with Bob last week, and how Peter and I were, well, we don't think we should be using the terms speech tools. We think we should be more descriptive. And then Bob comes back and he says, well, a lot of people like the fact that there's a name for something, which to some degree I do agree with. But I think one of the reasons why having all of these names for different, quote, speech tools complicates things is because we have all these names, but nobody really knows exactly what's happening. And a big part of that is because a pullout or a prolongation or whatever you want, or whatever technique you want to talk about here, means different things to each person, and no one is going to understand a pullout the same way.
Wow.
And I'm going to get off my box right now. How about that?
It's a good point, Eric.
Eric, that was a good box to be standing on, and that goes back to Johnson, too. I mean, if you think about, how do we, meaning is within us. It's not sitting out where we're, it's not like a thing. I mean, right. Meaning is individually determined, and the pullout can mean something different to the client. It can mean something different to a different clinician. And getting back to this chapter, I mean, being more descriptive is I think one of the reasons, that's why Johnson says we need to be more descriptive about the way we, not just the way we present information to our clients, but we need to be more descriptive when we're talking to ourselves and our clients do.
Yeah, and again, it reminds me so much of the Dean Williams approach to talking about stuttering. Okay, there's so many. I'm going to jump around here. I want to make sure we talk about what Johnson and Mueller meant by acceptance, because, Eric, I think a few weeks ago we were trying to figure out how to discuss or define acceptance, and I think we struggled with that a little bit. And then Charlie sends us this gem of an article, this truly classic article that I'm ashamed to say I've never saw before a couple of days ago. So thank you, Charlie, for exposing us to this. So here are a couple quotes I put together from different pages of the chapter. You do the best you can, and then when there is nothing more that you can do, you do this. You accept the rest. You learn to live with grace with your limitations. Be the thing that you are, but be a good one. Now, Charlie, some people would say that that's surrendering to your stuttering. What would you say, Charlie?
Well, I'm going to go back. I'm going to put it in context, because I think this applies to everything, not just stuttering. Stuttering's just one aspect, and it is, in fact, it's the opposite of acceptance or surrendering, I think. I think that it takes a lot of courage to recognize. You know, I would have loved to have been a baseball player, but, you know, the fact that I can't hit and I can't catch, that kind of got in the way. But you know what? I watch baseball, and I'm a really good observer of baseball, and that's all I'm going to be able to do. So I accept the fact I can't, you know, I'm not going to be a baseball player.
It's really hard to hit a fastball. I'm sorry, Eric. Go ahead.
No, I love this quote. And we did kind of get into it a little bit, Peter, but I think I brought up anyway how my experience right now in psychotherapy is really helping me think about my stuttering too. And that, like, sometimes I just have to let go. Like, I can't be really adept at everything that I want to be really adept in. You know, I think what's hard is kind of figuring out, like, how long you kind of go out there and see if you're really adept at something. And then, when is it time to kind of let things go or accept the fact that, well, hey, maybe you're not going to be able to be as good as this as you want to be. But I also want to say that I don't think it's giving up. And that's what I had initially felt like for a really long time. And that's what made it so hard. Like I felt like I was surrendering if every once in a while I used a different word, you know, or switched a word or something, just to help me get through what I was saying. It doesn't feel like surrendering when you think about it and make a conscious decision to be okay with what might happen sometimes.
I think those are really good points, Eric. And, you know, we sometimes, Eric, are, I don't want to say defensive, but we're often concerned about what other people think. And Johnson is just so darn confident in his writings. And him and Mueller, they basically say, well, why would we want to agree with other people? You know, these are our thoughts, and that's
exactly.
It.
Right. Yeah.
In fact, they go as far. Oh, Charlie, I love this quote. This is wonderful. I wish our field had this spunk now. They write, I think we must be sensitive to the degree to which our culture, I think any culture, tends to be anti-intellectual, anti-genius. I mean, they're saying that some of their colleagues are anti-genius. I love it. So I want to bring up another part of acceptance here, but maybe we should take a moment, Charlie, if you could just briefly tell us who was Wendell Johnson, because he was not a speech language pathologist.
Well, he was, but he wasn't. I think he was of the.
Oh, he was. I'm sorry. Okay.
And I'm not an authority on this, but I know that he was. You know, I mean, he was around the Travis era. I think he came after Travis, but and they were in. It was at the advent of the development of speech pathology as a profession, and his background is clinical psychology, okay. And. I think that there's a big disservice done to Johnson because of the diagnosogenic theory and then the monster study. And I think most people associate, you know, when they think of Wendell Johnson, those are the two things they think about.
Yeah.
And Johnson was really, he was a general semanticist, number one. And that the stuff he's been reading really reflects that kind of a perspective. Those other things are things that certainly that he engaged in, and he did a lot of research in speech pathology. But I mean, when I read Johnson, when I think of Johnson, I think of this stuff first.
Yeah, and what is first of all, I stand corrected. He was a speech pathologist. What is general semantic? Because I don't even know if technically that field still exists.
There's a level of existence. It's not where it was at one point in time, but it's just a study of meaning and how we symbolize and we're symbol users, and it examines uses of symbols and how we use them, whether it's in our own heads or in society.
And a lot of that comes through in the chapter, and hopefully we'll have time to touch on some of that. So there's, I want to read one more quote.
I just want to jump in for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
So,
would that kind of be associated with exploring the perceptions that people have of certain words and the meanings that they have of those words and how maybe what they're thinking a certain word or phrase or whatever means might be off from what actually is happening? Is that kind of the deal there?
Well, that's a huge part of it, and the fact that meaning is experience-based, and we all have different experiences in how we determine meaning. So it's another reason, just the word stuttering, I mean, it's not a bad word, but it's not a very productive word, because what does stuttering mean? Well, it depends on who you ask. And it's, to me, an abstract term. And we need to be more descriptive. If we're going to describe a specific behavior, if I just said, oh, geez, well, and people have told me, oh, he just stuttered. And I'm like, no, I didn't. But it's that person's definition of stuttering that led them to say that.
Yeah, and this conversation is going to take us in a moment to a big part of the chapter, which is the IFD disease. But right before we get there, I just want to sort of wrap up acceptance. They say, yeah. Johnson and Mueller, they say, and here's a quote, "You accept what you must accept until you can state more clearly and more concisely the problem as you now see it. Then you go on to make another change. You are behaving scientifically. You are engaged in productive behavior." And what I take from that is, wow, they're saying that acceptance is the process of change. So it's not just, oh, I'm a person who stutters and that's okay. It's you're constantly making changes and you're constantly examining where you are and where you want to go. Do I have that about right, Charlie?
Oh, you stated that very clearly. Absolutely. And that's why I said it's the opposite of surrender. It's It's being able to be okay in your own skin. And of course, knowing that change is the only thing that everything is, there's reality, everything's always changing. And the whole, one concept behind this book, Living with Change, the Semantics of Coping, it's learning how to cope with this reality that things change. And one huge one, I think, in self-development, whether you stutter or whatever, is being able to be okay with who you are, recognizing that things change and everything's in process of change.
I think that poses certain challenges for hosting a radio show, Peter. In the sense that we talk obsessively about stuttering, right? Mm-hmm. And what we say one day might a year, 2 or 5 years later be, you know, completely different. And we have a completely different idea. So, yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
And that's a good example of, right. I mean, we're always, this moment right now is just now. Tomorrow is going to be a different moment. And aren't we allowed to, based on our observations and our construings of what we get from those observations, change our perceptions? I mean, mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. And earlier in the chapter, they wrote that you today are not you yesterday, and you doing today is different from you doing yesterday. And I love that. I mean, they're basically giving people permission to change, permission to see themselves differently, to allow themselves to be different. And that's really powerful, because when I can say from my experience, when I was in those really, really bad years, I didn't know that change was possible. I didn't know that I could be somebody different tomorrow than I was the day before.
Yeah. I'm just going to add to that. This is from the text too. Now is something new. You are different than you were. This situation is different from any you have ever known. Look for the differences so that you can see reality as it is.
Mm.
That's huge.
Yeah, I sort of feel, and maybe I'm really wrong here, Charlie, so please correct me if I'm off base, but the neuro-linguistic programming thing, people, that I really honestly just don't get. I've tried it on. Do you think they're trying to pull something from what Johnson was saying? I mean, or is that giving them too much credit?
Oh, no. I think that they do draw from some of this stuff. But, you know, the first person, I mean, Johnson has another article. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's called The Belief in Magic.
Yes.
And well, you know how he felt about that. I mean, there's nothing magical. You use the scientific method. You make observations. If somebody says something, you ask them, well, what do you mean, for clarification? How do you know? So you can, you know, to get validation. And then the next question is, and what then? If you've made the observation and you realize, oh, wait a minute, that's not exactly how I thought. Well, then you have to make some change.
I think that was the first time that you ever gave the benefit of the doubt to NLPers.
Well, yes. I'm going to ask you an impossible question that I could honestly see you getting asked if you were to present on this topic at some ASHA conference or something. So if somebody were to raise their hand and say, Mr. Osborne, what you're saying is very interesting, but where is the evidence that acceptance is really the process of change? I could see somebody asking that sincerely, and it's a tough question.
Yes.
How would you answer that?
I guess I wouldn't have a really good answer. I'd have to answer it the best. Boy, that's a really tough question. And I think that I don't know if there is an answer. I guess the first thing we have to do is figure out, how do we measure this?
Mm.
I mean, if we're going to get evidence, how do you measure something
that
like this?
Yeah. I mean, Would you go, I mean, I could see being asked that question, and my response would be, well, part of evidence is your experiences as a person, as a clinician, as a person who stutters, as somebody who's around people who stutter. And there's a lot of evidence that I've picked up in my work that change doesn't happen overnight, that it's incremental, and that change leads to more change, and that perhaps there's an intermediary step where you might be in a place where you don't want to be a year from then, but that was a very important step to get from A to C. You have to step on B for a while. That might be the road that I would take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't do a very good job of answering that question, only because I don't have an answer for it.
Well, I do think you brought up a great point about the limitations of measurement. I mean, when people raise their hands and say, well, where is your evidence, it's kind of like, well, there, you know, if you're counting moments of stuttering, well, that's hard enough to get two people to agree on what's moments of stuttering or what's moments of quote fluency. But anything past that, you're getting into really complicated waters.
And I think now my answer would be, after having reflected on it, would be, what do you mean by evidence? And now that's a real Johnson question, because I'm using the what do you mean by evidence, because evidence means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
I love doing Stutter Talk because you're really making us think. That's a great answer. I really like that. Mr. Jackson.
Yeah, but it took me a while.
No, hey, we got all the time we need. This is the internet. Eric, did you want to jump in there?
What? At first I would have said, oh, well, Asha places too much of an emphasis on this huge term evidence, but I realized that might not be the most productive response. I think what you guys are saying, I think that there's a perception in the field of what evidence is, and it always gets this hard data connotation. And when we're talking about evidence in fields like ours, especially with stuttering, where we have all of the sticky stuff, the emotional stuff, and the cognitive stuff, it's like where it gets really complicated, and we can't just produce hard data. It just doesn't work. So there's some kind of disconnect there that I just think needs to be consistently pointed out.
You know, and I think there's some exciting things going on, though, in our field regarding restructuring what we are regarding as evidence in stuttering therapy. And I think qualitative data is, I know, you know, Walt Manning's been talking about narrative therapy, and I just think there's a lot of potential in qualitative analysis of what I would construe as evidence.
Yeah, but I feel like we're still gonna have those people who, you know, if it's not hard data, it's just not evidence. But
well, real briefly, Charlie, because I want to get back to the Wendell Johnson. But you know, in our field, some people count moments of stuttering, and that is the big piece of evidence in their eyes. What is qualitative data to our listeners who don't know?
Oh, geez, and I'm just kind of learning it. I've been working with John Tetnowski. I mean, that's his area of expertise. I know a lot of it involves conducting interviews with people and then going back and looking for different themes. So you're not really starting with a question. You kind of arrive at it just based on the information you're getting from the person in terms of what's important. And I think this goes back to change too, and the whole discussion that we've been having. I mean, if we were just, if we had our little counters in our hands, this stuff would just blow right past us.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very true. I want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. Peter and Eric here with our guest, Charlie Osborne from the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. Where is Stevens Point, Charlie?
It's if you get a map out and see Wisconsin and you kind of put your finger right in the middle of the state, you lift up your finger and you'd see Stevens Point. We're right dead center.
It's a very rural, you were saying before.
A lot of farms.
Kind of nice and relaxing.
Yeah.
And different than Brooklyn and New York.
Much different. We do have some excellent microbreweries, but that's another topic.
Well, we will have to get... I don't know about you, Eric. I'm sure we agree that I'm starting to think we need to get Charlie and Bob on the same show. Microbrewery will fit right in, too.
We can turn my apartment into a microbrewery.
Very good. So, Charlie, one of the points in the chapter that I would like more understanding of is when Johnson and Mueller talk about IFD disease, which stands for idealism to frustration to demoralization. What is IFD disease?
And isn't it interesting that this was the first time I ever heard of it when I read this. And I think we can talk about it from a narrow perspective regards to stuttering and stuttering therapy, and you could broaden it to any aspect of life. And basically it is that many of us, I include myself in this, because I think most of us have this ideal of what we want. And because it's so ideal, there's no way we can ever reach it. And in our attempts to try to reach this, and I think Johnson uses the term popular, you want to be popular. Well, what is popular? It's such an ill-defined term. Or what is wealth? You want to be wealthy. Or I want to be fluent. And you set this goal that the likelihood of reaching is almost nil. And as a result of that, you're not reaching it, and it makes you feel frustrated. And if you have these continued experiences of frustration because the goal is way too high, I mean, I could be going on about baseball yet, but I gave it up. I had to accept the fact I can't. Okay, jump back to IFD. But repeated experiences of frustration then eventually will lead to demoralization, and you just feel like a miserable failure.
He gives an example of... He was saying that he asked some of the women in his college classes what salary they wanted their husband to make. And all of them, or most of them, he said, listed salaries that were above average. And he said, well, if all of the women in the class expect their husbands to have salaries that are above average, there's going to be a lot of disappointment in this class.
yeah.
And that's a brave... I'm sorry, please.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's a brave thing for him to write. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's an example, granted it's a dated example, of human nature. I mean, if you think of how inundated we are when you turn on the TV and you look at the commercials, look how happy they are, look at the houses they have, and at some level we're thinking, well, I want that. And, you know, these are commercials. They're made up. It's fantasy. You can't get that. But if that's what you strive for, you're guaranteed to fall on your face. Mm-hmm. I want to be fluent. Well, I've told my clients, you know, well, people think I'm fluent. You want to sound like me? And almost a person, they're like, no.
And we get tastes of fluency, though, and that's what makes it so difficult, is that we get these tastes of fluency, and it feels so nice, and it feels so easy.
Mm-hmm.
He, in leading up to, I'm sorry, did I just cut you off, Charlie?
Nope.
No, that was me talking under my breath. I didn't have anything to say, so please.
In leading up to their discussion on IFD disease, Johnson and Mueller wrote, "It is better to talk about our health than our operation. It is better to talk of abilities than disabilities. It is better to stress potentials than limitations. And they're not saying pretend you don't have a problem. They're saying talk about it when you need to, but really focus on what you can do. How do you think this relates to where we are now with stuttering?
Oh, isn't that a great segment? And it's quite the opposite. It's not saying just ignore. It's just saying focus on the positive. Focus on your ability, not your disability. And who wants to hear about your operation? But I mean, when you were saying that and I was listening, I thought, you know, how many people do I know who stutter that I consider to be really good communicators? In fact, way better communicator than I could ever hope to be. And I don't stutter. Well, I think that I think about why is that? Well, that's just because that's who they are, and yeah. that's what they're good at. And I would shy away. I mean, do I want to MC an event? No, I'll go and hide because I don't want to. But then I see somebody who stutters and they do it, and they're really good at it. And I think that's an example of, you know, it's a little different than what you were just talking about, but I think it is an extension of that. Focus on what you can do and do it.
Yeah. I'm glad that you told us about his history with studying the meaning of words, because now that you say that, it's becoming clearer and clearer why this chapter is so powerful. I mean, he's basically saying, what does he say about success? There may be something wrong with trying to be successful when we really don't know what we mean by successful. And if success is the opposite of failure, I mean, is that really the world that we want to live in, where there's no gray ground, where it's, I mean, because it sounds like what he's saying is stuttering and not stuttering. And if you stutter, you're a failure. Am I taking it too far? Is that what he's getting at?
Oh, well, that's how I take it. Exactly. That two valued either or kind of thinking. Well, if I stutter, I'm a miserable failure. And the only way I'm going to be successful is to not stutter. But he talks about this in another chapter, and so do other general semanticists, about developing a multi-valued orientation where everything's on a continuum. So it's not either or, it's shades of this and shades of that.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of developing a feeling of success, you have to have a multi-valued orientation.
You know, there's so many things about this chapter. I want to make sure, Charlie, that we haven't missed any aspect that you would like to bring up or talk about.
Well, I'm sure after the fact there's all kinds of them, but I liked the three things that he talks about that we can do as clinicians, too, and we've kind of touched on those already. And I'm looking for them right now. I think
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wasn't exactly sure what the three things were, because he's sort of, I don't want to say he rambles, but he has an expansive way of getting thoughts out.
Doesn't he? Yeah.
That's a nice way to put it, Peter.
I think the three things were listening, sharing information, and acceptance. Are those the three things, or did I get it wrong?
No, those are the three things, but being able to listen with being a non-evaluative listener. And I think there's a level of acceptance there too. You can tell me what's on your mind. I'm not going to judge it. But then the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to show you the things that I know that may apply to what you just told me and see what you can do with them. I like this because it's our role is more to help this person, not to tell them, okay, you want to be this? This is what you have to do. It's different. It's helping them explore and discover what they have to do. And that's why I think therapy, when I see about, I mean, in our era of evidence-based practice, and we talk about, well, look at the evidence for this program. And my first thought is, well, who's the clinician?
Yeah.
I mean, we know the clinician has probably the most effect in the therapy room. And the technique you're using probably, you know, it's irrelevant if you're a really good clinician. And what does a good clinician do? They listen acceptingly. Yeah. They help the person try to come up with different strategies. We give the information that we have. That's why we go to school, and then we help them employ whatever it is they've, you know, works for them, and then you help them accept, and then you accept the person. You know, you did really, you worked really hard on this. This is good. Look what you're doing now.
Yeah.
I gotta say too, I think it's important to point out also that, yeah, of course the therapist is a huge piece, you know, but a lot of the techniques, if you want to, strategies, whatever, are not as different as a lot of those therapists claim them to be.
Right.
And so, you know, when it's emphasize that a particular technique works is this percent effective in eradicating stuttering. It's like, you know,
it is. I mean, oh, can we bring those words on here?
Because I got really one. Fine. No, I have one more thing I have to bleep out. Thank you, Eric. Oh. Man, no,
I'll do this show.
You know, you can curse Charlie. We'll just have to take it out. It's fine.
Oh, okay. Well, going back to what you just said, and that third thing that we do, and you said the effectiveness of the technique, shouldn't we construe this differently and talk about the effectiveness of the person that's using the technique?
Yes.
And isn't that what it's all about? And the third thing about Johnson, he says, and he's talking about he says, as a counselor, I can do for my counselee is this. When he has done his best, I can do one more thing. One thing more. I can accept him. I can be representative of all the millions of people who would accept him. And so I tell him, I hope that he can accept himself. And that's at that moment in time, because realize it's at that moment where he's accepting, but we acknowledge that tomorrow's another day too. And so it doesn't mean you're at the end and this is where you are. It means this is where you are right now. And, you know, you've really worked at this. You've done the best you can, and look what you have to show for it.
Okay. I think that now is a good time to take a little break, and then we'll come back.
Sounds good.
Bones of an impressive romance scattered all across the sand. A secret safe with all the world, too vain to seem so capable. Can you hear it calling? Do you feel warmer as the hired hand is barred?
Hi, this is Phil Schneider, speech-language pathologist, and I've been very involved in the issue of stuttering for about 39 years now, and my life has recently been enriched by an incredible vehicle for learning and developing a vast perspective, all in the comfort of my home, or while driving in my car, or while taking a walk in the woods. All I have to do is connect to stuttertalk.com or Stuttering 101, and I feel supported by a community of people who deal with this issue professionally, who struggle with this issue, who are challenged with this issue, who care about people who are, and it just broadens my perspective, and it gives me lots of food for thought in an enjoyable, relaxing, comfortable, and convenient way. And I want to be a part of making sure this open, candid, meaningful dialogue continues for years, and that people all over this country and all over the world get this and can hear it and can participate. So I feel privileged to be able to participate and become a shareholder in StutterTalk.com. And I've opened up the website, StutterTalk.com, and gone to that donate button so that I can be a partner in helping to make this happen.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. Peter writes as Eric Jackson here with Charlie Osborne, who's being very generous with his time today. Thank you, Charlie.
Not a problem.
And I'm just going to say quickly that when I read the Johnson-Muller chapter, I started to understand better why my own speech therapy with Phil Schneider was just so darn good. Because he did all of those things all the time. He listened. He told me what he knew, and he accepted me. and he helped me do those things. It makes me happy to sort of figure out the quote magic, to get closer to why that was such a good experience. So there's one more piece from the Johnson-Muller chapter I want to bring up. And here's the last quote. "We do not have to accept either of the two great folk assumptions about problems. The one is that all of our problems caused by forces outside of us over which we have no control. The other is that all of our problem is inside of our skin, as if we were sort of a surprise package tightly tied, and if you'd open it, you would find all these interesting little things inside. This is spooky. That kind of language is spooky." I mean, I just love that, Charlie. It's basically saying, in my eyes, don't worry so much why you're stuttering. You are stuttering. Now deal with it. Do I have that about right?
Well, I don't know what right means. If that's how you're getting it, I think then you probably do have it right. To me, that sounds about how I have it, too. I think it kind of crosses into some of the Williams stuff about animistic language, where it's like this stuttering is this thing that's inside of you. And maybe I'm going misinterpreting what you were saying. But one of mine, and I can't find the quote right now, but he says, "I think what we need to do is we need to perform an itotomy."
Yeah. That you know what? This was the quote where I contacted Bob Quisel, and I wrote, "Hey, it looks like Johnson is ripping off Dean Williams." And if I understood him correctly, Bob's like, "Well, it might be the other way around." Because they both do talk about this concept of, and by the way, nobody is ripping it. Anybody off, I'm just joking, but they both do talk about stuttering as not being an it. It's not this magical entity that happens to you. You know, and one could even make the argument that I think has been made that if they had the research that we had now, they might sort of have a harder problem saying that just because of the genetic research and the neurological research. But as far as therapeutically speaking, I mean, right. Isn't it powerful to know that this is your thing to deal with and you're going to be the one who has to deal with it? Anybody? Anyone help?
Well, I think that's it. I think when in this context, it is from a perspective from therapy, recognizing that you're dealing with a specific kind of behavior, and that we as clinicians are able to help structure change through structured experiences in therapy, it helps the person realize they have a choice. It doesn't mean that they're not ever going to stutter, but it means that they have a choice. And isn't that what locus of control is? It means when I open my mouth, I can choose to talk this way. And sometimes it may not work out. Okay, fine. And now I feel like I'm rambling. Is this making sense?
Yes, I'm making a lot of sense. Yeah.
Because I'm going back to Williams right now. There's something from another chapter that he wrote a few years ago on a perspective on approaches to stuttering therapy. It's in a textbook called Controversies About Stuttering Therapy, and I think it's 1979. Yeah. But he's talking about, just listen to this quote because I think it fits. "To be clinically effective, information should be presented in conjunction with structured experiences. The purpose of the information is to direct observations made during the experiencing of the event. Thus, people can assess the possibility of a previously unrecognized relationship between the ways they're behaving and their beliefs of why they have, in the past, behaved that way." But it's just this idea of helping a person, and you can say, well, it's because of this, this, and this, and someone can listen. But if you can help somebody through an experience and say, "Well, look what you did here. How was that?" And they go, "Wow, that was pretty good." That's huge. And I think that's this. I think it goes back to this notion of the stuttering as an it thing. And I think if it's perceived as something that you do, and you know, you're right with all the genetic evidence. Yeah, this is why you do it. But I think it just makes it more. I don't know. I think it casts it in a more positive way.
I mean, it's almost like it goes back to the who you are today or yesterday is not who you are tomorrow. Or, mm-hmm. or who you are yesterday is not who you are today. And it's almost like it seems that Johnson and Williams were battling against a human nature to believe in superstition of some sort or magical things that happen to you. That's where it's taking me. I mean, like last night, I've heard the story like 8,000 times. We were talking about my grandmother, who was a lovely woman, but who was, well, she had some major mental health issues. I think she was diagnosed with Pick's disease. For my whole life, my grandmother was just really, really off. Like, we knew she was ill for a very long time. And my mother tells a story about how, well, everything was fine until she fell down a couple stairs once. And then after she bumped her head was when her mental illness hit. And I've heard that story my whole life. And it always just struck me as utter superstition. Mm-hmm. But it seems like people who stutter do that too.
I think it speaks to that whole idea of revisionist history again, Peter. I think what happens a lot of time when we're not specific in therapy and we're not encouraged to be specific in therapy or just in our life, and we're not encouraged to really think specifically about things, scriptively about things, we need something to like go back and attribute cause so it makes sense. But I think so many times it does us such a great disservice, you know? Like my parents, they told me for like 20 years of my life, I thought I stuttered because I went in to get a tonsillectomy. Is that what it's called when you go in and get your tonsils out?
I think so, and I can't believe I've never heard this story.
And I think so for 20 years I thought that I stuttered because when I went in for this tonsillectomy, I had a 106 degree fever for like a couple of days. And it was just something that I believed. And I think on my parents' part, that's like huge revisionist history. It's like, oh, well, what makes sense to me now? Oh, well, it was probably that thing. And then it made everybody feel more comfortable, I guess, to some degree. Oh, well, that's what did it. But, I mean, come on. That's not what did it.
Well, if you can blame an event, then you don't have to blame yourself. That's true. Not that your parents deserve any blame, but it's really easy for parents or people who stutter to blame themselves.
I love my parents very much.
I love my parents too. Okay, Charlie, I lied. There's one more quote I really have to read. It's one of the best, most powerful things in the chapter. It's at the very beginning where they write, "We find ourselves talking out of a verbal knowledge mainly, making words about words, putting labels on things, and then reacting to the labels as if they were the things." That is so darn powerful. Can you take that to the next step or talk about that a little bit?
That is a kernel from the field of general semantics, and one rule is the word is not the thing. It's because, you know, I mean, in reality, we perceive things, but then we attach meaning by putting a symbol to it. We all derive our meanings differently, and oftentimes, reacting to the word is not looking at the evidence. You're reacting to what you heard or what was said without exploring or verifying to be sure that that is indeed what is going on, whatever was represented. I think that's what that means.
Yeah,
and oftentimes when I know, like for myself, I have to tell myself, because if I'm trying to sort through something, and I mean, you know, we do that with using language, and there are times I have to examine. Now, wait a minute, what am I saying when I say this? And I have to go back and I have to look for evidence and verify it, and sometimes it helps a lot.
that's why we had the fluency challenge on Stutter Talk recently, where we encouraged people not to use the word fluency and to replace it with something else.
Full circle, Peter. I think we should end this. but, Charlie, thanks so much for joining us today, man. It was great to have you on.
I really appreciate you inviting me, and keep up the good work. I mean, you guys are putting out some good stuff.
Thank you.
Same to you, Charlie. So we hope you'll come back on for some more Stutter Talks in the near future.
I'd love it.
You've been listening to Stutter Talk, stuttertalk.com.
Thanks again, Charlie.
Thank you.
Okay, excellent.